From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armilla, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk Shakespeare. The guy made up a whole lot of words, and you might be surprised by which ones we still use. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do, of course, every week, Kathy Petrus and Ross Petrus. Kathy and Ross, wherefore art thou? I guess I know the answer to that. Your parents named you Kathy and Ross, so that's wherefore art thou, Kathy and Ross. I also know where you are, by the way. Kathy, you're at your home in Armilla, Spain. Hello.
How are you?
Well, how am I? It is tree pollen season and also range burning season here where I live. And so if my voice sounds a little funny, you can imagine why. Ross Petrus, at your home in Toronto. How are you, Ross?
I'm doing fine. We had a lot of pollen too, Fletcher, so I'm dealing with it as well.
It's so much fun.
So no, doing great. I'm actually sort of depressed though, because Kathy just told me this is, I think, triple witching for cicada season. And do you guys, I love cicadas, but we're not going to get them up here.
Oh, really?
We don't have them here either.
No, and one of my earliest memories as a kid was Mr. Bush, our wonderful next door neighbor. And I went out and we were collecting, you know, the empty skins of the 17-year cicadas. And then, of course, we also had every year the one-year cicadas. Mm-hmm. So I love cicadas, whatever, but we're not going to get them up here.
We have cicadas in Spain. I didn't know that. I know we have locusts because I keep seeing locusts on our terraza, but I didn't know we had cicadas.
You do have cicadas. You have the ash cicadas.
Yeah, I had no idea. I mean, me, nature. Come on, Ross. You know.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot you. Yeah, because actually, Kathy, you really should know it because we used to read Gerald Durrell. And he mentioned Gerald. You know Gerald Durrell, actually, it should be pronounced. Do you know him, Fletcher?
No, I don't.
He was a zoo guy, a collector of animals for zoos, but he was really a big conservationist, but he grew up partly in Corfu. And he would talk about
Ross
being
and
a kid.
Ross and I were addicted to his books.
We loved him. He would talk about, you know, dealing with animals in Corfu. And he did mention cicadas, as I recall.
I don't remember, Ross, but I used to blip over the nature parts. I just like the fun parts.
I love the nature parts. That's so funny.
I have a question. Did Shakespeare ever mentioned cicadas?
Fletcher, I'm going to keep talking while Ross looks it up.
That's exactly what I was doing. Cicada, Shakespeare. I don't think he did. Yes. Here, there's an interesting article. Shakespeare knew his insects.
Shakespeare covered 7 insect orders. Coleoptera, beetles. Hymenoptera, bees, wasps, and ants.
Yes.
I'm just doing this off the top of my head, Ross. You right, know? Yeah.
So it looks like the answer is possibly.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I just realized, though, I was just thinking, the ancient Greeks had it, because in Greek there's tetix, which is cicada in ancient Greek. So whatever. Anyway, moving along, away from bugs.
Today we are talking a lot about Shakespeare and words that come from Shakespeare. First, though, you had something shameful that you wanted to talk about. Not shameful that we did, but that someone else has done.
No.
For once, it's not me. No, this is something that actually outraged me. And I talked about it with Ross. I got an email, one of my email newsletters I got from 404 Media. And they're saying that Google Books is now indexing AI-generated books. So if you type in a search into Google Books, you might get, and we tried it, you might get something that was actually just written by ChatGPT, not by a person. And the fascinating thing was in the article that you can find them in product reviews, academic journals, and online articles. This is all bad, but now Google Books is we're really pushing it. And what you do is if you search Google Books and you use the term, quote, as of my last knowledge update, unquote, that is something that's directly from ChatGPT. It's an answer that was generated by AI. And it's amazing how many came up.
It probably was, Kathy. I mean, because you never know. Someone could have actually written that and not been part of it. The odds are very high, though, that it is part of...
I don't think a person would say, as of my last knowledge update.
I completely agree with you, but you do never know. And someone's going to come up with it as we, next time and go, well, actually, this book I wrote and I said this. So I'm just covering all bases here. But no, I think that's just horrible. I mean, this is apparently becoming quite common. There are also articles I've read on people saying, use ChatGPT to write books and make a lot of money. I wrote 15 books last week, and it's just clogging the net.
Mm-hmm.
But the other interesting aspect of what Kathy was just mentioning is we frequently mention Google Ngram, which uses books to determine what's being, what words are being used and which words are not being used. If ChatGPT is entered into the Google Books, then Google Ngram, which basically analyzes word usage, becomes completely unusable.
Yeah.
Because it's then not talking about people's word usage, it's talking about AI word usage, which is something completely different.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how that's going to turn out, because right now I think the books that are included in the Ngram only date back to 2019. Mm-hmm. That was the most recent update. So
right.
I think that we're going to see a huge change if this continues in the next update, which will be, I don't know. As of my last knowledge update, I'm not sure.
Wow. See, there we go. Someone used it. Gee.
Yeah.
Or is Kathy AI? We don't know now.
This is why I know nothing of nature. I am man-made.
I think we know this, but the internet is becoming less and less reliable as an actual information source. And I think younger people definitely realize that. It seems like they are turning less and less to this huge mess that is the internet. I don't know where else you go for some things, because that's kind of where we've pushed everything is the internet, but you have to be really careful about where you're getting your information now. And like you said, I mean, even something that's been, at least as far as we know, reliable, like Google Ngram, is now basically not going to be.
I do think, though, you have to triangulate. I think Google Scholar using or JSTOR using, academic articles, which even there, I mean, even with before, ChatGPT, a lot of stuff isn't reliable. But if you keep the one advantage the net still has is you can keep piling up research. If you're basically really rigorous, I think the net is extremely useful. But I think you're right, Fletcher, on a basic level of just something quickly looking up something, it can be dangerous.
And I think what concerns me right now, I'm looking at Google Scholar and a slew of ostensible academic articles that include, as of my last knowledge update, out of the wazoo. Because you were just saying, Russ, you have to layer upon layer. But if the layers are already compromised, it starts getting worse and worse. Because someone will write an article based on something that might be faulty, and then so on and so on and so on.
Do you remember, Kathy, years ago we were thinking of doing a book? We were calling it Micro Trending. We found there was an article, and it was all over the place, how vitamin C, if you take 1,000 milligrams or something like that, you can get kidney stones, which is possible. But the interesting thing was every single article, we tried to trace it back, and they all went to one study, which had like 10 or 15 people in it, one of whom got kidney stones. I don't want to get into the science because I have no idea if it does or not. But the interesting thing was that they were all over the place. And they were all from, for the best of our knowledge, we could find only one study, one time, one study. And everyone, layer upon layer, what Kathy just said in support of what she just said, everything was really relating to that. But it might not be directly related. It might say, as Jones said in his article on vitamin C, 1999, this. But then Jones, if you look at Jones got it from Billings, and Billings got it from McPherson, and it was all traced backward. We kept doing it. We got sort of obsessive about it, trying to find, were there 10
studies? Obsessive about something?
No. We only found one study, and went back to Shakespeare. Good segue. No, it didn't.
That's a really bad segue.
Yeah, no.
Well, actually, though, I think we could safely say that Shakespeare did not use ChatGPT.
Mm.
No.
Yes.
nor vitamin C in its supplement form. So,
but he knew of cicadas. So Shakespeare was born in April 1564. We don't know the date. We do know that he died April 23rd, 1616, age 52 years. So April is Shakespeare month. Now the question is, we know that he's made up a vast amount of words and phrases, right? Mm-hmm. And we still use them today. Mm-hmm. So Fletcher, we're going to ask you, is it Shakespeare or not?
And I'm going to add one thing. Shakespeare, apparently, someone counted. He used over 20,000 words in his plays and poems. And the interesting thing about Shakespeare, which leads into what Kathy just said, is it Shakespeare or not? The first recorded use of over 1,700 words in the English language came from Shakespeare. He may have invented some, he may have introduced some, or he may have combined different words to give different meanings to some of these words. So if we're going to talk about the greatest wordsmith in the English language, guess what his name is?
Bill?
Bill Shakespeare, as we call him, yes. Very creative guy, I've heard. Although I always had a problem. I never loved Shakespearean plays like I think I was supposed to. Were you that way, Kathy and Fletcher, or not?
Totally. Or love them? Don't love them.
I often love at least decent movie adaptations of Shakespeare plays. Mm-hmm. I certainly struggle with just sitting down and reading them. That's definitely true.
My pet peeve is when, and this is really rotten of me, and I'm gonna get in trouble for this, is when people say, oh, the jokes are hysterical, and like they'll say something like, you know, Odds Bodkin, you know, up the stairs.
Yeah, I agree with you, Kathy.
And everyone goes,
oh, yeah.
And I don't think anyone really finds them hysterically funny. Well, I just don't.
That's why sometimes in a movie adaptation, I mean, that's why I can enjoy it so much, is because whoever's making the movie actually understands the joke and knows how to get it across in a way that works for a more modern audience.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start with, is it Shakespeare or not?
Actually, though, we could start with something else. We were talking about jokes, and we have a question. Did knock-knock jokes originate with Shakespeare's Macbeth?
Kathy? Oh, with Macbeth.
Knock-knock, Kathy.
Many say they did. I find this extremely dubious. The key is, they say, at the beginning of Act 2, Scene 3 of Macbeth, which I'm sure we all know by heart, after Macbeth has just killed Duncan, it's the porter scene, and a drunken porter hears a distant knock, and he's pretending to be the porter of Hellgate, and saying, knock, 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 who's there? And here's the comic part. The porter imagines different people coming up each time he says, knock, knock, who's there? I don't think that to me is not a knock, knock joke.
But here's the interesting part about it, though, was when did the knock, knock joke come into being? And this really surprised me. Apparently, they're saying it was the 1930s, the modern knock, knock joke caught on. Which I didn't realize. I always thought it was much older than that. I never really thought much about it.
Yeah.
I don't really know that I love knock-knock jokes, if truth be told. Odds Bodkin, I don't care for them.
Okay, so we've got a list of words that I will fail miserably at here. And so basically we're wondering if these originated or were popularized by Shakespeare.
Right. And we'll start with the first word, lackluster. Shakespearean or no?
Lackluster, as in it lacks luster. That seems so sort of wordplay-y, you know? You're tacking that lack onto the word luster, that it seems like it might have been made by somebody who was enjoying using the language. So I will say, yes, that came from Shakespeare, lackluster.
Yes! Lackluster is Shakespearean.
Wow, okay.
He also had, he did other stuff with lack, interestingly enough. So you're right with the wordplay thing. He had lack love, lack beard, lack brain, lack linen, which, I mean, I don't really think I thought of those.
I like lack beard and lack brain.
Yeah.
Outside of Shakespeare, they had other lacks. So therefore, the one question is, like, did Shakespeare invent it, or was he just one who you first recorded in print? Because there was also lack land from the 1590s for someone who was landless, lack learning for an ignorant priest, lack wit for someone not particularly intelligent, lack thought, similar, lack life. And my favorite is lack Latin for someone who doesn't know Latin. I love that one.
That would be me.
It would be I.
Oh, please. You know what I say, Ross? Good riddance.
I knew you were going to say that. Great segue. So, Fletcher.
Good riddance. Okay. Let's see. What can I tease out here? Ooh, not a lot. It feels a little Shakespearean, but only because it seems like somebody would have said that maybe in one of his plays. Not that he would have made it up. No, I don't think so. I don't think this is necessarily Shakespeare.
I'm going to say to you, Fletcher, a gentle riddance to you.
Oh.
That was Shakespeare's term.
Oh, that's nice.
Good riddance, you're right. It was not Shakespeare.
Now, did that come after then?
Before.
So he just kind of played on that and said a gentle riddance to you.
Maybe.
Okay.
Other people said it too.
So. Yeah, okay, that's fair.
There was a lot of, this is one of those words, the concept of riddance, cleaning something out or getting rid of something, obviously, was very commonly used in interjections. Like you'd say, you'd have good riddance, fair riddance, gentle riddance. There was good riddance to bad rubbish, which I've heard, mm-hmm. and I always thought that was from the 20s or something, but no, that was from the 1500s.
Oh, wow.
So it was pretty common,
yeah.
That construct.
I like a gentle riddance. That feels nice.
I like a gentle riddance, too. Yeah. I like a fair riddance and a gentle riddance. They have a nice ring to them.
Yes.
Well, gentle riddance is like a nice good night. It's just sort of like, good night.
Speaking of good night, can I take a... just completely off track. I was thinking about this the other day. We don't really have in English a way to greet somebody when it's like after 10 p.m., do we? Aside from like hello. But like if it's 7 p.m., we can say good evening. But if it's like after 10 p.m.,
yeah.
If we're not going to say good night because that means you're going to bed.
No.
And you're not going to say good evening because it's not evening anymore.
That's a really good point. I usually say hi.
Yeah.
But that's a good point.
Yeah. I mean, we have good morning, we have good afternoon, good evening. Good night means I'm going
but
to bed.
But probably, didn't you probably used to say good night, right?
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
And then saying goodbye, the good night that means goodbye, didn't they usually say good morrow or something? Like, you know, see,
oh, yeah.
You.
Yeah. See you tomorrow?
I think
yeah.
They did, yeah.
Although, it's interesting, good morrow sounds so much nicer and classier than see you later, doesn't it? See you around.
So would you say good evening then at night? I guess
I mean,
not.
I mean, no, that's too late, weird. Right? It's not good evening anymore.
No, it's good night.
Yeah. But
but you're right. You don't say, oh, good night.
Right.
Friend.
Anyway, nothing to do with what we're talking about here. But the next word.
The next word is swagger. To strut in a defiant or insolent manner.
Swagger. Swagger. I can imagine a lot of Shakespearean characters swaggering.
Yes.
Now, did he bring us that word, swagger? That's a good word.
It is.
It is.
It seems like something somebody might have just made up off the top of their head. Yeah, that's Shakespearean swagger.
And you're correct.
Really? I am doing way better than I expected.
You're really, I'm very impressed, Ross. We should have made this a little harder.
Yeah, it's hard already.
Yeah. But yeah, this the earliest recorded uses are in Midsummer Night Dream, Henry IV, Part 2, and King Lear.
Okay, upstairs, Fletcher. Upstairs. Shakespearean or
upstairs.
Not?
Upstairs. Out of any context whatsoever, if you had just said, is the word upstairs from Shakespeare? I would have said, no, that's ridiculous.
Oh, that's nice of Fletcher. He's giving us a...
He's trying to be kind.
Yeah.
He saw you crying, Ross.
He did.
So it actually is upstairs. I mean, that seems like such a simple word.
Well, it's Shakespeare.
Wow, really?
Henry IV, Part 1, in this case, his industry is upstairs and downstairs, his eloquence the parcel of a reckoning. He did it meaning to ascend a flight of stairs.
But I mean, doesn't that seem like such a simple phrase that it would have been like in wide use?
That flipped me out, that one, for that exact reason.
Yeah.
How recent it is. It seems, I mean, they certainly had two-story homes in medieval times or whatever. I'd like to do some more research on that just to see. I mean, everything we've read, you know, OED and all of those definitely say what we just said. But there, what was done before? You know, what was said before? you know, Junior ascend. Is downstairs and Dad is upstairs.
Well, the thing that gets me, though, is as an adjective, upstairs as an adjective, the upstairs bathroom or whatever, mm-hmm. didn't come about until 1782. Wow. And as a noun, I'm going, like, as a noun, upstairs, the upstairs, you know, upstairs, whatever, is 1872. Wow. I mean, that's pretty remarkable.
I know it, but I don't believe it, really. You know what I mean? I mean, we're saying it. But it just does not feel correct to me on that one.
Yeah.
Or I'm wondering about there must have been a synonym that was used instead.
Mm-hmm.
He's up or he's down. I don't know. We have many houses with stairways, and we have the concept is there.
Up,
you know?
Up and I down, mean, yeah, right?
Yeah. And what are you gonna say? You know, like you go, Mom, where's Dad? And then she goes
on the floor above us. Yeah.
I guess so. No.
I think she just pointed.
I wish we had a word for that.
Yeah, right. I'm sorry, as I was looking up more about this, I just found out that restroom, which has nothing to do with this, but only became a euphemism for a bathroom, a toilet, until it wasn't, a restroom was literally a restroom until the 1930s. It became toilet.
Hmm.
Isn't English fascinating? Now, Shakespeare never used the term restroom, as I suppose.
Actually, I'm curious with, here everyone always says washroom. I wonder when washroom came into being.
Oh, wow.
You can always tell if someone's Canadian if they say washroom.
Mm-hmm.
My son was greeting people at Strand. He had a job, you know, like at the Strand thing. And someone comes in and goes, excuse me, where's the washroom? And then Alex said, oh, you're from Canada. The person goes, how did you know that? But, you know, he said washroom.
I have a feel for these things. The next word, alligator. 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 I mean, I don't even know if alligators are, you know, in the part of the world that where Shakespeare lived or would have ever been near.
Are you serious? The Thames River, all the people getting eaten by alligators every year? No, you're right. There are no alligators in England, in Britain.
Are there any anywhere close to there, alligators?
No. They have, you know, crocodiles would be in Egypt. But
I guess then the question is our word alligator, do we call it that now because Shakespeare used it in another way? I don't think so. I mean, maybe I'm just crazy here, but this doesn't seem Shakespearean. I don't understand.
As usual, you're correct.
Okay.
Many people say, though, that William Shakespeare invented the word alligator.
Really?
Our feeling is mm-hmm. no. It's basically a modified, anglicized version of the Spanish word el lagarto, which means the lizard. And when the Spanish conquered most of the New World, they saw these giant lizards, and they called them lagartos.
So the thing is Shakespeare, the people that say Shakespeare invented it like the anglicized way would be alligator for el lagarto, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it does appear in Romeo and Juliet, which is seemed like a very odd place for it to be, but it is. However, Ross and I did find out that in spite of these people saying it was Shakespeare, they do have their older things where they say in Spanish they were called lagartos. And this guy, A. Knivet. Knivet or Knivet, Ross?
I think it's Knivet, but anyway.
Knivet referred to alligators, and he said, which we call in English crocodiles, which is like making it even more complicated.
Uh-huh.
Like, but Knivet was before Shakespeare by 6 years.
Yeah, interesting enough, Fletcher, though, I mean, you raise an interesting question, though. Question for both of you on biology. Where would you find alligators?
I only know them in this hemisphere, the Americas, I should
right.
say.
They're also in China. I never knew that.
Alligators. Interesting.
There's a species in China, but everything else is crocodile.
Yeah.
I always like really didn't think much about either. I just thought, you know, whatever. They're big and they have teeth.
I honestly have thought way more about them than you might expect. I always have have been like trying to be sure about whether something is a crocodile or an alligator and how to tell them apart based on how they look. I don't know why this is something that's been interesting to me.
It's the pointy snout.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It was the snout.
Yeah.
Alligators are pointy and crocs aren't, or crocs are pointy?
No, the opposite.
Yeah.
Opposite. I always flip out by them, though, because when we were kids, our father was based in Egypt for a while, and we had friends, and they went down, he was like this, the friend's father was some sort of a scientist, and they went down the Nile and to the Ethiopian part or something, and Craig, my friend, said, yeah, like a bunch of people got eaten by crocodiles. And it always flipped me out, you know, ugh. Just the They're scary looking. Whatever. Yeah. But that's neither here nor there.
This next one, were we not doing this quiz, it never would occur to me that this might have come from Shakespeare. Skim milk? Come on, guys. Skim milk? Is that really Shakespearean? I mean, I would say no. I would say no way. Why are you even asking me this? But because you're asking me, I mean, I guess it has to be.
Henry IV, part one.
Wow.
For moving such a dish of skim milk.
Ross, stop that. Get a hold of yourself. This is one, though, now. Okay, it's the first time that it appeared in print, skim milk.
Uh-huh.
Meaning, mm-hmm. of course, milk with the cream skim off. I am sure that it was used by people. Because, I mean, I think that it's the first time you saw it in something. But I'm sure, like, your average farmer would talk about, like, you know, skimming the cream off the milk and say, where's the skim milk? You know, or pass the skim milk.
I think you're completely correct, Kathy. And my question would be, this is in a weird way, it goes back to Google Ngram and the dangers of looking only at written accounts of words usage. Because to me, probably in those days, there weren't that many cookbooks printed or whatever. So there may not be that many references to skim milk that have survived. But then indeed, Shakespeare may have been the first to actually do it. But I'm sure, I would be very sure this was used way before Shakespeare. So technically, Fletcher, technically, no. Given what we know, yes. So it's a yes and no. Or no and yes. Okay, Fletcher, elbow.
Elbow, sure.
Now, we're going to say elbow as a verb, not as a noun.
Oh, to like, now are we talking just to nudge someone or to like elbow them out? It doesn't matter. Like, I guess I'm just curious.
Yeah, you're being really technical here. Yeah.
He's thinking, Ross. He's thinking.
That's right. I'm stalling for time is what's happening. Okay, so elbow as a verb. So I guess to one of those two things, either to nudge somebody or to shove them out of the way. I like that. That's Shakespeare.
Yes. Yeah.
It really is.
Elbow, it came from King Lear, a sovereign shame so elbows him. And it was definitely a noun prior to that. People did use elbow, the noun,
mm-hmm.
but he's the one who changed it into also using it as a verb.
That's cool. That's really neat.
I just love, though, the etymology of elbow.
I know. I like it, too.
In Old English, it was eln boga.
And L is the length of the forearm,
uh-huh.
and boga is a bow or arch, which is cool. The bend of the forearm is what it was called in all Germanic languages, Dutch, German, Old Norse, etc. Well, I hate to be cold-blooded about this, but we've got to probably end this radio show because we're getting late. And I wanted just to throw in one really quickly. Cold-blooded is really interesting. It shows Shakespeare's real creativity. Cold-blooded, as the scientific term, was there. But he changed it. Apparently he did. He changed it in terms of a cold-blooded individual and in terms of the emotions of a person, which I think really...
That's cool, yeah.
Really typifies Shakespeare. I mean, a really creative fellow, even if we don't like his jokes.
Well, I'm sure they were hysterical knee slappers back then. But it's like nowadays, you know, you see an old comedy, sometimes they're not as funny as they used to be.
Yeah.
Shakespeare, not as funny as he used to be. You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petras records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petras from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay, Kate Hutchins, and Carly Cooper. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetras@gmail.com. You can find all of their books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.